Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf...
Just a minute.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, Mr. Ratzak.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Beverly Rohn. This is the ADA case in which the district court granted summary judgment to U.S. Tobacco, essentially and only on the grounds that Ms. Rohn was not entitled to the protection of the ADA, that is, she was not entitled to an accommodation because she was, in fact, doing her job. The difficulty with that finding we submit to this court is that it creates a dichotomy between employer and employee. As this court has said in Van Zandy and some of the other courts have held, an employer who goes beyond what it has to go to, an employer who extends some courtesies to the employee so that the employee can, in fact, do the job, is not bound by that extension of courtesy. An employer who gives the employee an extra day off is not limited or barred from raising the argument that that accommodation was too much of an accommodation, too much of a burden. But under the trial court's holding here, the employee who goes one step beyond, the employee who uses an heroic effort, to use the words of this court in the Zuma's case, is bound by it. So that you have a situation where an employee who basically tries, if you will, too hard is going to be prevented from then asking for an accommodation. The employee has to work until that employee apparently can come to the court with an affidavit from a doctor that says you can't do this anymore. And we submit that that's simply not the proper way to look at the benefits that the ADA are supposed to give employees. Now, U.S. Tobacco said, that doesn't matter, it really doesn't matter, Mr. Ratzak at all, or Ms. Rohn, because the accommodation you were looking for is a home office. You wanted to work at home, and the Seventh Circuit has said, under very exceptional circumstances, maybe you can work at home, but otherwise not. And we submit to this court that if someone is going to be entitled to work at home, and if working at home is a reasonable accommodation, it should be Ms. Rohn. And I say that because she's not the typical person who is looking for an accommodation to work at home. She's not a line employee or in Van de Zandy, a janitorial employee, somebody who, if you will, is a supervisee. She is not working under somebody else's supervision. And that was this court, as I understand it, that was the linchpin to Van de Zandy, is that supervision is needed. If there's supervision needed, we're not going to let you work at home. That won't work.
But in this case, we've gone from somebody who the trial court found could do her work while she's at work, to a situation where she's not at work at all, not at the workplace at all. That's a substantial, I mean, that's almost a 180-degree turnaround from the circumstances that currently exist.
If I understand Your Honor's question or comment correctly, she was able to do the job. She would have been able to continue doing the job, but what she was telling the court was, I need some accommodation at home in order to be able to do this job. The accommodation she needs, and I'll put it this way, the accommodation she needs is she needs the ability not to be in a public place of performance for her job all the time. That's the best way I can describe it. I can come to this court and argue before this court with some of the problems that she has, but if I have to stand before this court every day wondering if I'm going to follow myself while I'm standing here, at some point it is simply going to be too much for me.
Well, they did offer, as I understand it, an accommodation which would be come to work one day a week. Wasn't that what it was?
That was
come to the office one day a week.
That was a suggestion that they made from which they completely backed off of. I mean, that is long gone. There's two answers to that. One, they certainly have backed off that. They argue she's not entitled to be at home at all. The other,
she
never got an offer.
Didn't she reject that offer?
At the meeting, she said, that's not what I want. But that was not the final word, and that's the remaining point we have. There was no offer to her. She, in the first and only exchange that they had, said, no, I would really like to be able to stay at home when I need to be at home. and she's pointing out to the fact that her job, if you will, is more like a judge's job. I mean, the judges do their jobs very well from someplace else, but when there's oral argument, you have to be here. Her job is such that she can do her job from home, but when she's going to have to be at work, she's got to be at work all the time. It's not a job where she spends 2 hours a day doing something. She could spend months working at home and then moving on to the plant. But the bottom line is, she was never made that offer. This was a throwout during the discussion, and it never was followed up. There's no letter in the file. There's no official offer to her. If there had been, then
I'm
there would
not
have been.
Sure how much of this interchange has to be formal by letter or whatever. I mean, that there's no...
I agree. If someone had called her up and said, keeping in mind, and this is the key, they said they were going to get back to her. They said in that exchange, we need more information from you. They did not get back to her and say, you know, here's what we think we can do for you. Your demand is not reasonable. We'll do this, or we can't do that. It makes it very difficult for us to argue against something that's never been formally or even informally put to her. What they did at that meeting was a dialogue like you can have an oral argument, I guess. It doesn't indicate what the final result
is. Well, but the dialogue was, work at home, just come in one day a week. The response was, I don't want to do that. I want to be the master of my own fate when I'm going to come in and when I'm not. Right?
I disagree with that in the sense that Your Honor is saying that's a line drawn in the sand. The evidence is, and she explained it afterwards in her affidavit, I didn't mean to draw a line in the sand. I hate to use the word, but we're negotiating, we're bargaining to see where we're going to end up. It's something she said, but not something that was binding on her. And she is certainly, the record has indicated that that's not where she stands, that she in fact wants to work. At the same time that remark came up, that same place in her same notes, which I think is what Your Honor is referring to, the same notes that she had from that meeting, she said, I will be there when I have to be there. So if the court's going to look at it that way, you have a situation where she says two things that are mutually incompatible. I want to be there when I need to be there, but I will be there whenever I want to be there. I mean, whenever I'm needed there. She's indicated she's worked 20 hours a day, 7 days a week on some of these projects, and apparently she'll have to stand by that. That moves me to the final point that we want to make, and that is the question of the interactive process. This court has said in Bultemeyer that the court should find and indicate who was at fault for the breakdown in the process. Now, the district court here said this process broke down. There was only one meeting, and there was supposed to be another meeting. There was supposed to be some input back and forth, and there wasn't any. If there's one thing that's unclear in this country, it's what's supposed to happen when the process breaks down. But the Taylor case, which seems to be the only one on point from the Eighth Circuit, said that if the process breaks down and you allocate the fault or you put the fault on that or the blame on that to the employer, then the employee simply has to show a potential accommodation as opposed to a specific accommodation will work. In this situation, we submit that Beverly did show a potential accommodation which would work, and that was, I will be there whenever I have to be there when you want me to be there. But if not, then I think I should be able to work at home because I'm a supervisor, because I'm actually reporting to Nashville, I'm a liaison to Nashville, and I can do my work from home. And nobody in this case has shown why that could not be done, other than one individual for U.S. Tobacco who told his employer, his boss, I just don't think that would work. We don't know why. Unless the court has some immediate questions, I would like to defer to the EEOC at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Siner?
If it please the court, my name is Joseph Siner and I represent the amicus curiae, the EEOC. The commission is here only to address the narrow legal holding of the district court below that the plaintiff was not entitled to a reasonable accommodation because she could perform the essential functions of her job without an accommodation. The court's overly broad ruling misconstrues the reasonable accommodation requirement and threatens to foreclose a host of accommodations that would arise apart from those by an employee to perform the essential functions of the job, The court's holding is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute, the regulations, and case law. Indeed, the proper rule here is that absent undue hardship, an employer must provide job-related reasonable
accommodation. You know, we have a rule up there, you're not supposed to read your oral art.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just thought I'd tell you. You go ahead and do whatever you want to, though. Well, we're talking about rules, so I thought you ought to be
okay. I appreciate that, Your Honor. An employer must provide job-related reasonable accommodations to the known limitations of an individual with a disability. For purposes of this appeal, it is undisputed that Rowan is a qualified individual with a disability. The Commission also assumes for purposes of this argument that Rowan could perform the essential functions of the job without an accommodation. Thus, the sole question here is whether U.S. Tobacco is required to reasonably accommodate Rowan's disability-related limitations that do not affect her ability to perform the essential functions of the job. Discrimination under the ADA includes not making reasonable accommodations to the known limitations of an otherwise qualified individual with a disability. In no way does the plain language of the statute limit an employer's obligation to accommodating only limitations that affect the performance of the essential functions of an employee's position. In fact, the term essential functions appears only once in the ADA, and in a definitional section of the statute completely different from that section creating an employer's duty to reasonably accommodate the employee. The statutory to accommodate disabled employees is therefore unrelated.
What kind of impact do you think the rule you're proposing would have generally?
I guess it would be the same impact that it has had up until this point. It's not really a rule that we're proposing. It comes directly from the statute that an employee, absent undue hardship, an employer must provide job-related reasonable accommodations to the known limitations.
Well, there's no case law which supports your position.
Correct. There's no case law either way, but the statute and the regulations.
You're just saying there's no case law because it's a matter of course right now that the employers are doing this?
I would say that as a matter of course, and the fact that it really hasn't come up that often, that's the situation at this point. In addition, there are situations where an employee can perform the essential functions of the job and is still entitled to an accommodation, such as access ramps. An employee there can perform the essential functions of the job, but they just need some help getting to their place of employment, or modified work schedules. In that situation, an employee can perform their job. They just need a little help on when they can do it. There are numerous examples in the statute and the regulations of employees who can perform
But if you can perform the essential function of the job without accommodation, why do you need accommodation?
In some circumstances, an employee can perform the essential functions of the job without an accommodation. You're entitled to accommodation under the statute. Like in those examples that I just provided, the statute mandates that individuals
to and from their employment.
Right, to and from their employment, or modified work schedules, job restructuring, situations where the employee really could, but the statute contemplates the fact that these individuals will have some problems in performing their job and wants to level the playing field, to level the equal benefits and privileges of employment, Your Honor. If there's nothing further, I guess that's the main point that the Commission is here on, the fact that the holding of the district court below really was just overly broad. The fact that the essential functions, that an employee can't perform the essential functions of the job without an accommodation, that holding is just too broad in this instance, and we ask that it be limited upon review, and we ask that that this case be remanded back to the district court for the district court's determination of whether a reasonable accommodation should be provided absent undue hardship.
Thank you.
I would also like to cede any remaining time back to the plaintiff for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stenson.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Todd Steenson, and I represent United States Tobacco, which I will refer to as UST. At the outset, I think it's important to understand what is undisputed here between the parties, and the most important point that's undisputed is that, as this court recognized, Ms. Rowan has failed to identify any existing reasonable accommodation that she either requested of UST or that she needed. It's undisputed, as the court recognized, that she rejected numerous offered accommodations. And the appellant's suggestion that they weren't offered because they were only brought up in one meeting is simply misstates the record. There's no question from Ms. Rowland's notes that these were things that were offered to her, and she said, I do not want them. I will not accept anything but working at home on my terms. It's also undisputed that she has identified no other accommodation which she needed, either to perform any functions other than the essential functions of her job, or to otherwise enjoy equal employment opportunity. And finally, it's undisputed that she was always able to perform all the functions of her job. In fact, that's admitted in the question presented without any difficulties. There's no evidence in this record of how her conditions impacted her at work. Without any performance problems, and without...
Well, there's evidence of how it impacted her at work. I mean, she did have frequent times to use the bathroom and that, those types of things.
Yes, Your Honor, but she describes in general terms how often she has to use the bathroom. There is nowhere in this record, Mr. Rathsack suggested that she soiled herself. There's nowhere in the record where she suggested that that ever occurred at work, and importantly, she never suggested that the accommodation UST offered, which was to put a bathroom in her office, would not have dealt with any concerns that she had.
She said there was one across the hall.
That's correct, but if she has a concern about privacy, the private bathroom does address that. Now, I think it's also important to talk about the Van Zandt case and her request for an accommodation to work at home, because that's the only accommodation she requested, and this court has made clear that if the only accommodation someone requests is unreasonable as a matter of law, and they reject other reasonable accommodations, they're no longer a qualified individual with a disability. That's the Schmidt case. It's undisputed she requested no other accommodations, and it's undisputed that she rejected all the accommodations that UST suggested. Now, she suggested that her job is one where she simply comes in from time to time, is without supervision. That completely distorts the record. In fact, the evidence shows, and it's her job description, which is in the record, that, and Judge Shader found, that 60% of her duties require her to manage and supervise capital construction projects in UST's plant. To do that, she had to oversee the work of the outside contractors who were performing the construction work. She also was involved in planning these projects, which her supervisor, John Waddle, testified in an affidavit, required her to meet with numerous people in the plant in order to determine how the construction project would impact ongoing operations in the plant. She's admitted in her brief that her primary duty was to supervise these construction projects, and she's admitted on page 7 of her opening brief that she could not perform those duties from home. She's also admitted that there are oftentimes problems that come up on the spur of the moment, and that she couldn't deal with those from home. On the other hand, she suggested that the kind of work she could do from home using the computer takes up only 25% of her job, and she provides no evidence as to how she could perform these essential functions of her job, the construction management, oversight, responsibilities that require her, as the record shows, to be in the plant, to actually watch what these contractors are doing, to ensure that they're not interfering with plant operations, could be performed from home. She doesn't suggest any authority from this court or any court that has allowed an accommodation in those circumstances, and she never suggests how she could perform those functions, and indeed, she admits that she cannot perform them. As a result, because she's identified no other accommodation that she requested or needed, and has sought and rejected the other accommodations that UST offered, she's no longer a qualified individual with a disability. In addition, that lack of evidence bars her claim based on the interactive process for yet another reason. This court has recognized that an employer's alleged failure to engage in the interactive process in good faith is not itself a violation. And now, UST by no means acknowledges that it failed to interact in good faith. In fact, it did. It met with Ms. Rowan. It sought information about her medical condition, which she refused to provide for nearly a year and a half. That in itself, under this court's precedence, is enough to determine that she's responsible for the breakdown in the interactive process and therefore deny her claim. It met with her, it offered several accommodations, and she rejected every one of them. Now, Mr. Rathsack suggested that no further communication occurred. Well, in fact, no further communication was possible. We needed the medical information. She refused to provide it. We suggested several accommodations. She said, no, the only thing I will accept is a home office on my terms. And the record is clear that she never returned to UST and suggested that her mind had changed on that matter. She never suggested any willingness to ever accept any accommodation other than what she proposed at the additional meeting. As courts have recognized, you can't negotiate with a brick wall. And at that point, yet another factor that demonstrates Ms. Rowan broke down the interactive process, she suggests in her brief that the next step that should have occurred was to have UST's outside disability consultant review the evidence. Well, UST agrees with that, but we were unable to do that because Ms. Rowan refused to sign the release to allow the disability consultant to review that evidence. That in itself is sufficient to affirm the district court's decision. Now, getting to the point raised by the EEOC, it's undisputed by anyone, I believe, that in order, simply because one has a disability does not mean one is entitled to an accommodation. One is entitled to an accommodation only if that accommodation is needed either to allow the person to perform the essential functions of the job or to otherwise enjoy equal employment opportunity. And there's no dispute that Ms. Rowan was always able to perform the essential functions of the job. Now, the EEOC's argument is based on really facts that don't exist. Because first of all, Judge Shader never ruled that an individual who can perform the essential functions of the job is never entitled to any accommodation. What he ruled is that Ms. Rowan could always perform the essential functions of her job and that she didn't demonstrate there was any other basis on which she was entitled to an accommodation. Those are entirely different propositions. So the entire premise for the EEOC's argument simply does not apply here. But even assuming the EEOC...
Counsel, yes. And I asked you this before, and I think you're, or at least you responded in a way, that there is no evidence of the kind of testimony that at least I recall reading about the seal on on the bag being broken when she goes upstairs, all that kind of information. That's not a part of the record?
She testified in the record that those things occurred. However, her testimony was very vague, and she never testified that that occurred in the workplace. There's nothing in the record to show in any way how these conditions impacted her in the workplace.
Well, she said, when she would drive, I don't know if it said to work, but she had to stop occasionally because to use the bathroom, and it also affected the seal on the bag. Isn't that...
She did say that there were times when she had to stop to go to the bathroom on the way to work, as do many people. Getting to her argument that despite her ability to perform all the essential functions, let me just finish with respect to the EEOC. The other problem with the EEOC's argument is they have not identified a single accommodation that Ms. Rowan needed despite her ability to perform all the essential functions of her job. So their proposed rule is simply irrelevant to this case. There are no other accommodations that have been identified here that Ms. Rowan either requested or showed she needed. So one could accept the EEOC's rule as a general proposition, yet it still provides no basis to reverse the district court's decision here. Now, with respect to Ms. Rowan's argument that even though she was able to perform all the functions of her job, she's nonetheless entitled to an accommodation because she engaged in an extraordinary effort, that must be rejected for several reasons. First of all, it's waived, Your Honors. That argument was never even hinted at in the district court. In fact, Judge Shader expressly found that Ms. Rowan never argued that it was unreasonable to require her to work without accommodation despite her ability to perform the essential functions of the job. And the only thing she says in her reply brief is that we made a general reasonable accommodation argument. But that didn't raise this extraordinary effort theory. This is a brand new legal theory that no court has ever accepted. Judge Shader was never given the opportunity to pass on it. The record has not been developed with respect to it, and under this court's usual waiver standards, it should not be considered here. But in any event, the standard she proposes, I did the work by dint of extraordinary effort, is simply unworkable. She provides no explanation as to how a fact finder could make that determination. In fact, in her brief, she simply says, well, the fact finder, her reply brief, the fact finder should look at what my general limitations were and what the job duties are, and then make a guess. Looking back in hindsight, when she has never shown that she was ever unable to perform the job. In fact, she's shown that she was always able to perform it. So this theory, which has never been adopted by any court, as they admit, there's no regulation supporting it, simply is unworkable, and this court would be left with a flood of cases with people who could always work claiming this same extraordinary effort theory with no way to determine whether that in fact occurred, no standard by which this court or a fact finder could decide what is an extraordinary effort, what is not. Unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ratzak, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With respect to the question of whether an offer was made, I would submit to the court that if she said something during that first meeting that rejected something, that they need to tell her that your rejection won't work, and here's what else we can do, here's what we propose to do. But more importantly, I would point out to the court that the trial court found that the interactive process broke down. It just did not assign blame, which indicates that the trial court apparently felt that the discussion should have gone further than what they did. And maybe more importantly, the ADA point person, so to speak, Ms. Viesta with U.S. Tobacco, indicated she had no knowledge of any offer that had been made to Ms. Rowan. So I would suggest that there isn't evidence sufficient here to allow summary judgment to be entered on the grounds that an offer was made and rejected. With respect to the waiver argument that was raised at the end of their oral argument, I believe we answered it in the reply brief. The bottom line is she sued under the ADA alleging that she could perform the essential functions of her job, but said, I can't do them, and supported it with her deposition testimony and even with her answers to interrogatories. At page 6 of her interrogatories, which is Exhibit D to the record, she describes the stress that's created for her coming and going to work. She describes the restroom visits that take her away from meetings and take away from phone calls and so forth. So she does indicate those things that, in fact, caused her not to be able to do the job. The analogy I use is a frontline soldier. Maybe can stand in the front lines all the time. Can't stand valiantly on the front lines sometimes, but you don't send that soldier to the front line all the time. At some point, that person needs a break, and that's what she needed here. She's not all that different than the plaintiff in Baltimore, the janitor who couldn't do his job, basically because he just couldn't quite handle the load, and she couldn't quite handle the load. Unless your honors have some specific questions, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel again, and the case will be taken under advisement.